So, crazy, discovering crazy, that's the topic of my share now tonight, just starting. That's me, Sharon James, on Lagunas KX 935. I was prepping for this show, and I had a plumber with me dealing with a host of plumbing problems. And I said, well, you must have some crazy stories. And he launched into a million of them, but they involved crazy clients, people who were overtly crazy, were just hard to deal with, and you could tell it from the get-go. What I'm going to explore here is the crazy that lies underneath, the crazy that exists in people you thought were just totally normal, decent, kind, rational human beings that maybe you'd been living with for a few years or decades and suddenly discovered that they had kept their crazy secret. That applied to one story my plumber told me about a friend of his, a married friend. She was off on business a lot, and she and her husband had been having problems because she was away so much, and they just weren't getting on, and they decided to just try and go their own ways for a bit. He moved out, but he kept the key, and he would come and stay in her house when she was away to look after the children or the cat or dog, I can't remember which. And they were on amicable terms. They were just having a little distance from each other. He'd been drinking. She didn't like that. So he'd stopped. Anyway, she returned from one trip, let herself into the house and collapsed on the sofa to watch TV. And there was something sort of a little lumpy under the pillow. So she got up, tried to plump the sofa pillow, then actually removed it from the sofa. And underneath, there was a neat row of empty half-pint bottles of vodka, all lined up, a whole host of them in a row. One had pushed itself loose from the back, which was why she'd felt the lump. And my plumber said, why would anyone do that? Why would he leave all these empty bottles showing that he had an alcohol problem when that was part of the problem that they'd been having together? But why wouldn't he take them with him when he left? Dump them in a garbage can somewhere, or his own, or if he didn't want wherever he was staying to know, someone else's, some public garbage can. Why would he leave them there for his wife to discover? It's this hidden crazy that's also in full sight at some point that is the most disturbing. You know, I'm not going to dwell on this, but we've had a recent horrific experience of this gunman managed to collect a whole secret hoard of weaponry and create a massacre that we don't at this point understand. And then we hear that he was the most ordinary man, the least violently inclined in his family, where nobody was especially violent anyway, according to his brothers. And everyone's mystified by it. All they can point to is that his father was jailed, something their mother never told the children, for a violent crime. So maybe it was in his DNA. And then, of course, they show us a picture of him looking a bit mad so that we feel a bit better about it all. But, you know, nothing enacted in his life to date, and he was in his 60s, the Vegas shooter, pointed to overt madness and crazy behavior throughout his 6 decades in which he was both married and had other long-term relationships. I'm going to relay now a This American Life story that is Ira Glass's production, not mine, but I found it fascinating and I want to give it extra mileage on this, my share now. That's with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's one and only KX935. It's the story of a young woman who was the victim of identity theft. She had discovered that somebody had taken money from her bank account. She couldn't figure out what was going on.
But she figured, okay, no problem. Call the bank, explain the situation, they'll take care of it. She even figured out how it probably happened. She'd been visiting friends in Chicago, sitting in a coffee shop.
And this guy walked in wearing a windbreaker and sat sort of at the table next to us. And at one point, he just kind of brushed against me, and I had my purse actually hanging over the chair. And it wasn't until, like, after he had left and I went to pay that I realized that my wallet was gone.
But you just figured that was the person who stole your identity.
Yeah. My Social Security card had been in there, and I thought that was something you could do with that.
So she goes and closes out her bank account, switches to a different bank. Same thing happens. Money just starts disappearing. And she goes through several banks this way. Wherever her money goes, the identity thief arrives.
I was like, I don't really know what else I can do. I closed everything. I started to become just a very paranoid person all the time. Like, after this had been happening for a year or two, I was just very anxious all the time. There was one point where I thought that my mail was being stolen because I was like, how else is this happening? So I got a P.O. box and I got to the point where I thought someone was following me. Like, I was just so paranoid that I would try to find alternate routes to get to my P.O. box. I mean, it sounds so crazy looking back. To be honest, I didn't have that much money. I was working at a nonprofit children's museum and trying to wait tables to supplement my income, but my boyfriend at the time was helping me out. I always paid my rent. I didn't want him to pay for me or anything. It was very uncomfortable for me, but he would like buy the groceries and do everything. I would pay my rent and he would kind of take care of everything else.
And what did he do for a living?
So he was always into politics. So at that point he was working at the Massachusetts State House. Working for the president of the Senate. Fancy job.
And without him, she'd really be sunk. Because money just keeps vanishing from her bank accounts. So eventually, she just gives up on the entire banking system. She closes her last account, as the bank put all the money that was remaining, $1,000, into a bank check that she keeps in a drawer. Handles all of her finances and cash and money orders. Problem solved. At last. Until she and her boyfriend decide they're going to move. And she needs $1,000. And she goes to the top dresser drawer where she keeps all of her financial stuff, the receipts and statements and all that. And there's no check. And she's like, okay, well, maybe it fell behind the dresser. Maybe I put it somewhere else.
And so we tore apart the apartment, flipping couch cushions and opening drawers. And I was just like having a panic attack because this was all of the money that I had in the world. And we couldn't find it.
So she goes to the bank. And they were like, you already cashed this check. And they showed her a copy.
And then where my signature was my forged signature. And it was my boyfriend's handwriting.
Ta-da! But the story gets even more crazy. Quick reminder here that you're tuned to The Sharer now with me, Sharon James, on Lagunas KX935. Retelling of This American Life story that Ira Glass researched and produced about this young woman who was the subject of identity theft.
It was the boyfriend. After all, think about it. Who else could it be? In retrospect, Rachel says that she is sure there was some small part of her in the back of her brain, which was like, okay, what if it's him?
I mean, of course, it's something you would think about. And the banks are always like, do you have a boyfriend? It's the boyfriend. Any bank or police officer would always be, do you have a boyfriend? It's the boyfriend. It's always the boyfriend. And I was like, you don't know my boyfriend. My boyfriend is like the king of generosity and kindness. Just so giving all the time to everyone. Just giving. He just wanted to give.
You don't know my boyfriend. You don't know my wife. You don't know my spouse. You don't know my partner. You don't know them like I know them. This is one of the dangers of getting close to somebody. To get close, you have to agree, I trust you. I believe you. I know that what you say is true. You know what I say is true. And sometimes that is a mistake. There are downsides to being close to somebody. Let's talk about that for a change instead of how great it is to be married forever and blah, blah, blah. So when Rachel came back from the bank, from seeing her boyfriend's handwriting on the check that he stole from her, when she got back to the studio apartment that they shared and confronted him with the truth, obviously, you know, how is she not going to ditch him? But he sat in bed with her and did something. He broke down crying and he said, I have to tell you something.
And I don't want to tell you. Because I'm afraid that if I tell you, you're going to leave me. And that's when he told me that he has impulse control disorder, that he's been diagnosed with this for many years, and that he's done a lot of stupid stuff. And he said he was seeing a therapist and getting help for it.
So, okay, wait a minute. What is impulse control disorder? Of course, they've given it an official clinical acronym, ICD, according to a Dr. Ploskin in a site called Psych Central, people with an impulse control disorder can't resist the urge to do something harmful to themselves or others. It obviously involves addictions, alcohol, drugs, eating disorders, compulsive gambling, sexual peccadilloes and behaviors, causing suffering or humiliation to others, other adults or children, kleptomania, pyromania, trichotillomania, which if you haven't heard the word before means compulsive pulling out of your own hair, and intermittent explosive acts of rage. In other words, every negative performance that anybody will display at one point in another to one degree or another in their life can often start with a feeling of tension or arousal and lead to the pleasure and gratification and relief of the person exhibiting it. But afterwards, they can blame themselves and they can feel regret or guilt. So this is not necessarily behavior limited to sociopaths and psychopaths. And these acts may be unplanned, but those exhibiting them can feel a loss of control over their lives. Of course, there's attention deficit disorder, which is a relatively newly defined medical disorder. Before, we just thought people were too energetic or highly strung or bored or just generally not committed to whatever was in front of them. Now it's become an actual defined syndrome of epic proportions, and millions of people are on drugs to counteract it. Seems to suit the doctors and pharmaceutical industries too. And antidepressants are actually fed to people who have this ICD as well, which suggests that the neurotransmitter serotonin is involved in these impulse control disorders. But as for what causes them, scientists are at a loss, other than projecting that certain brain structures, including the limbic system, which is linked to emotions and memory functions, and the frontal lobe, which is linked to planning and controlling impulses and functions, affect the disorder. Hormones do too. With women, this might predispose them more to things like kleptomania and trichotillomania than the more violent and aggressive acts like pyromania and this, what's called intermittent explosive disorder. Sounds maybe more alarming than it is, and that it could run in families. But that's as much light as we seem to have on this impulse control disorder, ICD. And as a defense for extremely destructive behaviors when it comes to innocent victims, I'm not sure I'd buy it, especially if it's a hidden crazy and not an overt one. Discovering crazy is the topic of my sharing hour tonight. That's with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. Let's get back to this story of the crazy boyfriend with ICD as presented by this American Life's Ira Glass.
How long had you guys been together?
Probably 4 years. Three years. You know when you tell these stories and then you just feel like, how do you not know? You just sound so stupid. But back then, I think I needed to hear that there was some sort of medical reason. Okay, like he's not a bad person. He's just going through something that's out of his control and it's medical.
Yeah, it's interesting how a person would want that rather than the other thing.
Well, yeah, I would, like a bow I could tie up and be like, well, here's why. Not like, you've been living for years with a sociopath. Well, he went down to dinner in his Sunday best. Excitable boy, they all said. And he popped the pot roast all over his chest. Excitable boy. Just an excitable boy. He took in the 4 a.m. show at the Clark. Excitable boy, they all said. And he bit the usher's leg in the dark. Excitable boy, they all said. Well, he's just an excitable boy. They are.
just an excitable boy. After 10 long years, they let him out of the home. Excitable boy, they all said. And he dug up her grave and built a cage with her bones. Excitable boy, they all said. Well, he's just an excitable boy.
You're tuned to the Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. Discovering Crazy is the topic of my show tonight, and I'm playing you the story of a young woman who was basically being conned by her seemingly generous, seemingly lovely, undiscovered crazy boyfriend. As his defense for his behavior, he cited his impulse control disorder, given a new scientific notation of ICD. But as Ira Glass from This American Life, who broke the story, says, well, that can be an excuse for anything. Stealing from your girlfriend, sleeping with their best friend, taking the neighbor's Porsche because you just couldn't resist driving it, couldn't help myself. Any wrong, immoral impulse you came up with. But there you go, it has a ring to it. The clinical definition seems to make it more acceptable.
So, she accepted, all right, he has an impulse control disorder, and she believed the disorder is what caused him to steal the very last money she had in this world and forge her name on a check and then search for the check with her, pretending he had no idea where the check could have gone. But that's all she thought he did. That tiny morsel of truth is all she was able to take in at that point. She did not put together the whole truth, that he'd been stealing from her for over a year, that he was the identity thief, not some stranger in a dingy apartment in Chicago. He was the identity thief who made her so totally stressed out over money all the time, who drove her to the point where she was looking over her shoulder as she walked to her own post office box. They stayed together for another year and a half. And before you judge, okay, before you think, how could she do that, I'll explain how. It's really interesting, and I think it could happen to a lot of us. For starters, her boyfriend had been the one steady thing in her life. Right? She's going through this hard time with banks and credit cards, and it's not ending, and he was the one thing she thought she could depend on. It's just hard to let that go.
Oh, God. It makes me sound so stupid, but yeah, I really thought I knew what good was. Like, everything felt so bad and so hard to control. I was like, he has to be good. Because if he's not good, nothing is good.
Right, that's the whole premise. That's the premise of your life.
Right.
And,
yeah. Well, I was like, rationally, there's no way that it was him because, like, he literally supports me. He buys all of our groceries and he pays all of our bills and he is legitimately my personal army to try and figure out the identity fraud.
Right, so it just doesn't add up.
There's
How could that person also be taking money from me, the person who's actually paying for everything?
Right. Yeah. So I was like, why would someone steal from you and then spend it on you? It just didn't make sense to me.
And the outside temperature rises, and the meaning is all so clear. 1,001 yellow daffodils begin to dance in front of you, oh dear. Are they trying to tell you something? You're missing that one final screw. You're simply not in the pink, my dear. To be honest, you haven't got a clue. I'm going slightly mad. I'm going slightly mad. It finally happened, happened. It finally happened. Whoa, whoa. It finally happened. I'm slightly mad. cards short of a full deck. I'm not quite the shilling, one wave short of a shipwreck. I'm not my usual top billing. I'm coming down with a fever. I'm ready out to sea. This kettle is boiling over. I think I'm a banana tree. Oh dear. I'm going slightly mad. I'm going slightly mad. It finally happened, happened. Finally happened. Finally happened. I'm slightly mad.
See, before discovering crazy, you think it's you must be crazy. Discovering crazy is the topic of my Sharon Hour tonight. That's with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. And here's the conclusion of this American life story involving this poor woman who was the subject of identity theft, turned out to be her boyfriend. The story doesn't end there. Here is where it ends.
The weird financial stuff keeps happening. Rachel gets phone calls about credit cards that are in her name that she never took out and knew nothing about. Her car gets booted, even though Rachel never got a ticket herself. And occasionally the thought would cross her mind, okay, if I broke up with him, would all those troubles go away? And she would just kind of brush that thought away. Once, the boyfriend's stepmother said something to Rachel.
She was like the evil stepmom, that he hated her. And he kind of got me to hate her. And I realized years later, she was the only one who was onto him.
This happened early on. The stepmom said to Rachel, I hear you're having some kind of identity theft problems.
I was like, yeah. And she was like, do you guys like go over bills together? Like, do you guys ever do that kind of stuff together? And I was like, no, I don't want to do it. It stresses me out. And she was like, a really important part of a relationship is figuring out financial stuff. You know, maybe you should look into that, make sure that he's got things under control. You know, like really tried to get me to do stuff with him. And I know she said something sort of rude about him, like he's not great at this. And I shut it down. I was just like, you don't know. Because he made me hate her. So years later, I realized, oh my God, she tried to warn me. He had done such a good job of like protection that she's not even a candidate for trusting.
It's interesting to think about. What was in this for the boyfriend? Stealing from her? Making her feel so anxious and paranoid about her finances? And then stepping in to comfort her and save the day and help her out using her money?
Like he was the caretaker. It made him really happy. He really wanted to provide. I think he really wanted to be a provider. And he would like make me these fancy dinners every night, pack my lunch for work and stuff like that.
So, like I say, year and a half passes, and he asks Rachel to marry him. She says yes. She's really happy. Next morning, this happens the very next morning, she gets a call from their landlord, who the boyfriend had always dealt with.
And he was just screaming at me. He's like, I don't know what you and your boyfriend are trying to pull, but you owe me like $16,000, whatever it was. And you're being evicted, and why aren't you returning my calls? And I was like, I have no idea what you're talking about. And he was like, you're a liar, just like your boyfriend.
She'd be giving her boyfriend her half of the rent, but he hadn't paid the landlord in a year. And she was like, okay, well, where did that money go? And she started to look for it. She went through his stuff for the first time without him around and opened drawers and found all kinds of bills and credit cards in his name from American Express and Banana Republic and all kinds of other places, a whole secret financial chaos. And then they fight about how he'd been lying to her. And this is what breaks them up, though it takes a few weeks for them to break up, which I get. He'd been her college boyfriend. They'd been together 5 years. They were engaged. So, okay, it takes weeks. And during those weeks, horribly,
we started planning a wedding. I kind of went into like a catatonic state of existence where I went through the motions for like a month. We would go look at wedding places, but in the back of my mind, I was like, I can't marry this person, but I couldn't say it out loud.
So finally, they agreed they were going to take a break for a few days, think about things, talk to their families, and then come back and figure things out together.
And he went home to his parents, and I went to my parents, and I never, ever saw him ever again, never. Months later, I was living with roommates and put together that for years I had been living with this person who was stealing from me. Put together, oh my God, he wasn't working. He would get up every day, get dressed, and leave the house when I left the house, and he would pretend to go to work. I never went to his office. When he was working at the state house, he showed me his office from the car. He was like, look, that gold-domed building, that's where I work. I'm so excited. And I just realized I don't know anything that was real. I don't know when he was working or when he wasn't.
Like, you never met any of his office mates?
No. I heard stories about them all the time.
Oh, so he had names of people who he said he worked with?
Totally.
What were the names?
Well, I remember Ann from the state house. He had a boss. I think he had named him Rob. And I just remember because there was this one time he called me at work and he was really upset because he was at the airport. And he was like, we're all supposed to go on a trip to D.C. And it ends up there's a problem with the flight and we have to get put on the next flight and there's not enough room for everyone. And I'm really bummed because I don't think I'm going to get to go on the trip because I'm not important enough. Like, I'm not high up enough. And he ended up not being able to go on the trip, and he was calling me from the airport telling me the story, and I felt so bad for him. But he didn't work, and those people weren't real, and he wasn't at the airport. I don't know. He was probably at home.
We had this idea that when we discover the truth, it hits us all at once. We see what's real and what isn't in a flash of understanding. In fact, the thing that we call an experience like that is the moment of truth. That's what we say, the moment of truth. We do not say the dragged out year and a half of the truth. But that's how it goes sometimes. Sometimes we come to accept the truth slowly, in stages. Sometimes we have reasons to hold on to a lie. We're not ready to let go of the world that the lie preserves, the people the lie keeps close to us. And we release the lie from our hand, one finger at a time.
That you've ever had. You think I'm psycho, you think I'm gone. Tell the psychiatrist something is wrong. Over the bend, entirely bonkers. You like me best when I'm off my rocker. Tell you a secret, I'm not alarmed. So what if I'm crazy, the best people are. Listen, my brain is scattered. It can be Alice, I'll be the
mattress, something is wrong. Over the bed, entirely bonkers. You like me best when I'm off my rocker. Tell you a secret, I'm not alarmed. So if I'm crazy, the best people are. You think I'm crazy? Craziest friend that you've ever had. You think I'm psycho, you think I'm gone. Tell the psychiatrist something is wrong. Over the bed, entirely bonkers. You like me best when I'm off my rocker. Tell you a secret, I'm not alarmed. So what if I'm crazy, the best people are. All the best people are crazy. All the best people are.
Crazy. Discovering crazy is the topic of my Sharon Hour tonight. That's with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. Moving on, here's a rather wonderful speaker, Daniel Ariely. His background is in psychology and human and economic behavior. And I'm going to play you a little bit of his TED Talk where he attempts to explain some of our less rational behaviors, particularly our delusional ones.
I'll tell you a little bit about irrational behavior, not yours, of course, other people's. So after being at MIT for a few years, I realized that writing academic papers is not that exciting. It's not fun to read and often even worse to write. So I decided to try and write something more fun. And I came up with an idea that I would write a cookbook.
And the title was going to be Dining Without Crumbs, The Art of Eating Over the Sink.
And it was going to be a look at life through the kitchen. And I was quite excited about this. I was going to talk about a little bit about research, a little bit about the kitchen. You know, we do so much in the kitchen, I thought this would be interesting. And I wrote a couple of chapters, and I took it to MIT Press, and they said, you know, cute, but not for us. Go and find somebody else. I tried other people, and everybody said the same thing, cute, not for us. Until somebody said, look, if you're serious about this, you first have to write a book about your research. You have to publish something, and then you'll get the opportunity to write something else. If you really want to do it, you have to do it. So I said, you know, I really don't want to write about my research. I do this all day long. I want to write something else, something a bit more free, less constrained. And this person was very forceful and said, look, that's the only way you'll ever do it. So I said, okay, if I have to do it, I had a sabbatical. I said, I'll write about my research if there's no other way, and then I'll get to do my cookbook. So I wrote a book on my research, and it turns out to be quite fun in two ways. First of all, I enjoyed writing, but the more interesting thing was that I started learning from people. It's a fantastic time to write because there's so much feedback you can get from people. People write me about their personal experience and about their examples and what they disagree, nuances. I mean, I've known really heights of obsessive behavior, which I think is just fascinating.
In this TED Talk, Daniel Ariely shows some examples of visual illusions. He shows a table that looks like a rectangle from a north-south perspective, but more like a square from an east-west perspective, even though the table's of the exact same length. And it's really odd. So our eyes deceive us a lot, but so do our brains, which we don't as much realize. You're tuned to the Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935, talking tonight about discovering crazy. And Daniel Ariely, a professor of psychology and behavioral economics at Duke, has been researching this to some extent and made some discoveries and some analogies.
You know, vision is one of the best things we do. We have a huge part of our brain dedicated to vision, bigger than dedicated to anything else. We do more vision, more hours of the day than we do anything else. And we're evolutionarily designed to do vision. And if we have these predictable, repeatable mistakes in vision, in which we're so good at, what's the chance that we don't make even more mistakes in something we're not as good at? Something we don't have an evolutionary reason to do, we don't have a specialized part of the brain, and we don't do that many hours of the day. And the argument is that on those cases, it might be the issue that we actually make many more mistakes. And worse, not have an easy way to see them. Because in visual illusions, we could easily demonstrate the mistakes. In cognitive illusion, it's much, much harder to demonstrate the mistakes. This is one of my favorite plots in social sciences. It's from a paper by Johnson and Goldstein. And it basically shows the percentage of people who indicate that they would be interested in giving their organs to donation.
Daniel Ariely shows a chart of which countries are best at this organ donation in terms of percentages. This is obviously an audio medium, but he's going to give you the gist of the results of this survey. And it shows a proclivity in all of us that's a kind of irrational psychological bent.
You basically see two types of countries. Countries that seems to be giving a lot, and countries that seems to be giving very little or much less. The question is why? Why do some countries give a lot and some countries give a little? When you ask people this question, they usually think that it has to be something about culture, right? How much do you care about people? Giving your organs to somebody else is probably about how much you care about society, how linked you are. Or maybe it is about religion. But countries that we think about as very similar actually exhibit very different behavior. For example, Sweden and Denmark, Germany and Austria, the Netherlands and Belgium. And finally, depending on your particular version of European similarity, you can think about the UK and France as either similar culturally or not. But it turns out that from organ donation, they're very different. But the Netherlands is an interesting story. Turns out that they got to 28% after mailing every household in the country a letter begging people to join this organ donation program. Right, so you know the expression, begging only gets you so far? It's 28% in organ donation. But countries that seems to be giving a lot, they're doing a much better job than begging. So what are they doing? Turns out the secret has to do with the form at the DMV. And here's the story. Countries that don't give a lot have a form at the DMV that says something like this. Check the box below if you want to participate in the organ donor program. And what happens? People don't check and they don't join. But countries giving a lot have a slightly different form. It says check the box below if you don't want to participate. Interestingly enough, when people get this, they again don't check, but now they join the program. Now, think about what this means. You know, we wake up in the morning and we feel we make decisions. We wake up in the morning and we open the closet and we feel that we decide what to wear, and we open the refrigerator and we feel that we decide what to eat. And what this is actually saying is that much of these decisions are not residing within us. They're residing by the person who's designing that form. When you walk into the DMV, the person who designed the form will have a huge influence on what you'll end up doing. Now, it's also very hard to intuit these results. Think about it for yourself. How many of you believe that if you went to renew your license tomorrow and you went to the DMV and you would encounter one of these forms, that would actually change your own behavior? Very, very hard to think it will influence us, right? We can say, oh, these funny Europeans, of course it would influence them. But when it comes to us, we have such a feeling that we're at the driver's seat. We have such a feeling that we're in control and we are making the decision that it's very hard to even accept the idea that we actually have an illusion of making a decision rather than actual decision. Now, you might say, you know, these are decisions we don't care about. In fact, by definition, these are decisions about something that will happen to us after we die. How could we care about something less than something that happens after we die? So a standard economist, somebody who believes in rationality, would say, you know what? The cost of lifting the pencil and marking a V is higher than the possible benefit of the decision, so that's why we get this effect. But in fact, it's not because it's easy, it's not because it's trivial, it's not because we don't care, it's the opposite. It's because we care, it's difficult, and it's complex, and it's so complex that we don't know what to do. And because we have no idea what to do, we just pick whatever it was that was chosen for us.
My analyst told me that I was right out of my head, the way he described it. He said I'd be better dead than alive. I didn't listen to his jive. I knew all along that he was all wrong, and I knew that he thought I was crazy, but I'm not, oh no. My analyst told me that I was right out of my head. He said I'd need treatment, but I'm not that easily led. He said I was the type that was most inclined when out of his sight to be out of my mind. And he thought I was nuts, no more ifs or ands or buts. This
say, as a child, I appeared a little bit wild with all my crazy ideas. But I knew what was happening, I knew I was a genius. What's so strange when you know that you're a wizard at three? I knew that this was meant to be. Now I heard little children were supposed to sleep tight. That's why I got into the vodka one night. My parents got frantic, didn't know what to do. But I saw some crazy scenes before I came to now. Do you think I was crazy? I may have been only three, but I was swinging. They all up at angry young men. They all up at Edison and also at Einstein. So why should I feel sorry if they just couldn't understand the idiomatic logic that went on in my head? I had a brain, it was insane. Oh, they used to laugh at me when I refused to ride on all those double-decker buses, all because there was no driver on the top.
What, no driver on the top?
And the chick is twisted, crazy, oop-shooby, here flip city.
My analyst told me that I was right out of my head, but I said, dear doctor, I think that it's you instead, because I have got a thing that's unique and new. To prove it, I'll have the last laugh on you, cause instead of one head, I got two. And you know two heads are better than one.
Okay, bear with me, listener. This is kind of a long way to get into my theme tonight, which is discovering crazy on this Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Lagunas KX935. I'm playing you a TED Talk by Daniel Ariely. He is a professor of psychology and economic behavior at Duke University, and he has a few insights into our latent craziness, which can emerge when a situation becomes too complicated for our brains to cope with.
I'll give you one more example for this. This is from a paper by Redlmeyer and Shafir, and they said this effect also happens to experts. People who are well-paid, experts in their decisions, do it a lot. And they basically took a group of physicians, and they presented to them a case study of a patient. And they said, here's a patient, he's a 67-year-old farmer, he's been suffering from a right hip pain for a while. And then they said to the physician, you decided a few weeks ago that nothing is working for this patient. All these medications, nothing seems to be working, so you refer the patient to hip replacement. So the patient is on a path to have his hip replaced. And then half the physician, they said, yesterday, you reviewed the patient's case and you realized that you forgot to try one medication. You did not try ibuprofen. What do? Do you pull the patient back and try ibuprofen, or do you let them go and have hip replacement? Well, the good news is that most physicians in this case decided to pull the patient and try ibuprofen. Good for the physicians. The other group of the physicians, they said, yesterday when you reviewed the case, you discovered there were two medications you didn't try out, ibuprofen and piroxicam. They said, your two medications didn't try out yet. What do? You let them go or you pull them back? And if you pull them back, do you try ibuprofen or piroxicam? Which one? Now, think of it. This decision makes it as easy to let the patient continue with hip replacement, but pulling them back all of a sudden becomes more complex. There's one more decision. What happens now? Majority of the physicians now choose to let the patient go to hip replacement.
And I find it kind of funny, I find it kind of sad. When people run in circles, it's a very, very mad world. Mad world. Children waiting for the day they feel good. Happy birthday, happy birthday. Made to feel the way that every child should. Sit and listen. Went to school and I was very nervous. No one knew me, no one knew me. Hello teacher, tell me what's my lesson. Look right through me, look right through me. And I find it kind of funny, I find it kind of sad. The dreams in which I'm dying are the best I've ever had.
find it hard to tell you, 'cause I find it hard to take. When people run in circles, it's a very, very mad world. Mad world. Pelagian world.
You're tuned to The Sharer now with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. We've just been hearing from psychologist and behavioral expert Daniel Ariely how doctors chose to give someone an excruciating and expensive hip replacement instead of ibuprofen and another over-the-counter $2 drug because they'd gone too far down a wrong diagnostic path to have the energy to turn back. This is how we make important decisions, to choose something dire rather than something easy because we don't have the nerve or the stamina to make the better decision. That is crazy. Discovering crazy in our seemingly logical and professional doctors is extremely troubling, right? Daniel Ariely concurs.
The thing is that no physician would ever say piroxicam, ibuprofen, hip replacement, let's go for hip replacement. But the moment you set this as the default, it has a huge power on whatever people end up doing.
Sound familiar, listener? See that young woman from the This American Life story? If you'd said you're going to hook up with a sociopath for 4 years, he's going to steal from you, and as soon as you find out, disgusted as you are, you're going to agree to marry him, and then as soon as you plan the wedding, he's going to bugger off and you will never ever hear from him again. Do you think she would have embarked upon this relationship willingly? I mean, even that succession of events is pretty crazy. Giving someone hip replacement instead of a combination of ibuprofen and something you buy off pharmacy shelf for a couple of bucks, that's pretty crazy. The motivation behind it is pretty crazy. All this stuff that we do and we think is following some logical progression, stuff that might make sense to us even if we are rational human beings and professionals and understand the decisions we're making, they're still crazy decisions, right? And if you told us ahead of time that these are the decisions we'd be making, we might not believe you. But somewhere along the line, we convinced ourselves that we were behaving rationally. Discovering crazy is the topic of my Sharer Now tonight. That's with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's one and only listener-supported, member-supported public FM radio station, KX935. Okay, let's get back to behavioral economics and psych professor Daniel Ariely in his TED Talk.
I'll give you a couple of more examples of irrational decision-making. Imagine I give you a choice. Do you want to go for a weekend to Rome, all expenses paid, hotel, transportation, food, breakfast, the continental breakfast, everything, or a weekend in Paris? Now, weekend in Paris, weekend in Rome, these are different things. They have different food, different culture, different art. Now, imagine I added a choice to the set that nobody wanted. Imagine I said a weekend in Rome, a weekend in Paris, or having your car stolen. It's a funny idea, because why would having your car stolen in this set influence anything? But what if the option to have your car stolen was not exactly like this? What if it was a trip to Rome, all expenses paid, transportation, breakfast, but doesn't include coffee in the morning? If you want coffee, you have to pay for it yourself. It's €2.50. Now, in some ways, given that you can have Rome with coffee, why would you possibly want Rome without coffee? It's like having your car stolen. It's an inferior option. But guess what happened? The moment you add Rome without coffee, Rome with coffee become more popular and people choose it. The fact that you have Rome without coffee makes Rome with coffee look superior, and not just to Rome without coffee, even superior to Paris. Here are two examples of this principle. There's an ad from The Economist a few years ago that gave us three choices. An online subscription for $59, a print subscription for $125, or you could get both for $125. Now, I looked at this and I called up The Economist and I tried to figure out what were they thinking. And they passed me from one person to another to another until eventually I got to a person who was in charge of the website, and I called them up, and they went to check what was going on, and the next thing I know, the ad is gone and no explanation. So I decided to do the experiment that I would have loved the economist to do with me. I took this and I gave it to 100 MIT students. I said, what would you choose? And these are the market share. Most people wanted the combo deal. Thankfully, nobody wanted the dominated options. It means our students can read. But now, if you have an option that nobody wants, you would take it off, right? So I printed another version of this when I eliminated the middle option.
That was a non-combo for the same price as the combo.
And I gave it to another 100 students. Here's what happens. Now the most popular option became the least popular, and the least popular became the most popular. What was happening is that option that was useless in the middle was useless in a sense that nobody wanted it. But it wasn't useless in the sense that it helped people figure out what they wanted. In fact, relative to the option in the middle, which was get only the print for 125, the print and web for 125 looked like a fantastic deal. And as a consequence, people chose it. The general idea here, by the way, is that we actually don't know our preferences that well. And because we don't know our preferences that well, we're susceptible to all of these influences from the external forces, the defaults, the particular options that are presented to us, and so on. One more example of this. People believe that when we deal with physical attraction, we see somebody and we know immediately whether we like them or not, attracted or not. This is why we have these four-minute dates. So I decided to do this experiment. I showed some people a picture of Tom and a picture of Jerry, and I said, who do you want to date, Tom or Jerry? But for half the people, I added an ugly version of Jerry. I took Photoshop and I made Jerry slightly less attractive. The other people, I added an ugly version of Tom. And the question was, will ugly Jerry and ugly Tom help the respective more attractive brothers? And the answer was absolutely yes. When ugly Jerry was around, Jerry was popular. When ugly Tom was around, Tom was popular. This, of course, has two very clear implications for life in general. If you ever go bar hopping, who do you want to take with you? You want a slightly uglier version of yourself. Similar, but slightly uglier. And the second point, of course, is that if somebody else invites you, you know how they think about you. What is the general point? The general point is that we have this beautiful view of human nature. You know, what a piece of work is man, how noble in reason. We have this view of ourselves, of others. The behavioral economics perspective is slightly less generous to people. But there is a silver lining, and the silver lining is, I think, kind of the reason that behavioral economics is interesting and exciting. You know, are we Superman or are we Homer Simpson? When it comes to building the physical world, we kind of understand our limitations. We build steps, and we understand our limitations, and we build around it. But for some reason, when it comes to the mental world, we somehow forget the idea that we're limited. And I think if we understood our cognitive limitations in the same way that we understand our physical limitations, even if they don't stare us in the face in the same way, we could design a better world. And that, I think, is the hope.
Certainly. If we all saw clearly and we saw the same things, would define them in the same way, wouldn't that be great? Unfortunately, one person's sanity is another person's craziness. And our crazinesses aren't always apparent to each other. You are listening to The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Lagunas KX 935. My topic tonight is discovering crazy. And I can remember this one time. It was several decades ago, so my memory is going to fail me about the actual details. But I was living in New York. I'd recently arrived from London, and I got an apartment in Gramercy Park because it was a part of New York that reminded me a little bit of London. It was a tiny duplex with an iron staircase. The living room and kitchenette was on the ground floor, and the bedroom and the bathroom up a wrought iron circular staircase, and it overlooked a courtyard. It was a very pretty apartment. But I was moving out to move in with somebody, and I needed to assign the lease. And this lovely lady arrived, who fell in love with the apartment, as I had when I'd first seen it. She was this fresh-faced girl from out of town, sort of my age, which was in my 20s. We really got on, and she also loved my furnishings and wanted to buy them. So we took it from there. And she filled in the forms for me to give to the landlord, her address and all her contact details, and must have given me a deposit to give the landlord. Anyway, We talked for about a couple of hours, new best friends, and off she went. And then it all fell apart. She wasn't who she said she was. Her contact details didn't pan out. The money wasn't good. Her checks for the remaining rent and deposit and my furniture bounced. She was not answering her phone. And the other number I had for her, a work number possibly, nobody knew who she was. She was basically a fraud. And during this time, or just after, I happened to be walking down 3rd Avenue and there were these two women sitting at a cafe in full goth makeup. And one of them looked familiar, but completely different. And I realized it was her, this girl, Rita, I think her name was. Not that there's anything wrong with full goth, but this was 180 degrees from the girl who'd presented herself and was now staring right through me. So you just never know with people, really. But most of the time, we have to take people and a situation on faith, because life would be unbearable otherwise if we didn't. You just walk around paranoid and not opening any doors to anything. Still, discovering crazy is alarming and discombobulating, unless we have a bit of remove from it, and then it can be funny. So that's it for my share an hour tonight. If you want to hear this Discovering Crazy show again, go to kx935.com/shows/the-sharon-hour. That's sharing without the G, hour with the H. Or you can check it out on iTunes. But do go to our website anyway, kx935.com. We have a great concert coming up and lots of other shows and stuff for you to listen to. And then come back every Sunday night at 6 for this, The Sharon Hour, with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX 935.